You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, and thank you for downloading The Agenda's podcast from the 2nd of February. And on the programme today, we found out why you soon could be walking or cycling to work in air-conditioned comfort, even in the height of summer. Baharash Bargarian from the developer URB explained his ideas for the so-called loop in Dubai. We also took a look at the growing popularity of cycling in Abu Dhabi, which has its own loop being built, with Al-Nakara Al-Khalili, who's the CEO at Abu Dhabi Cycling Club. Meanwhile, if you fancy a bird's eye view of the Palm, there's a new way to do it, and involves a giant white balloon. We spoke to Claire Horn, who's the general manager of the Dubai Balloon. Plus, while the rest of the world is laying off tech staff, we're in the midst of a hiring boom in the UAE. That's according to recruitment expert John Armstrong, who's seeing the biggest demand for tech professionals in 12 years. He joined us on the programme to explain why. And the UAE's festival in celebration of innovation has kicked off for February. We found out how you can get involved with Abir Talak, the director of the Mohammed bin Rashid Centre for Government Innovation. Plus, the future of medicine is personalised. That's according to G42 Healthcare. We spoke to their Senior Director of Operations, Francesco Redivo, at the Future Health Forum at the Museum of the Future in Dubai. Now, a plan for a 93-kilometre-long cycling and running indoor track for Dubai has been revealed. The loop would be a climate-controlled year-round structure designed to reduce the city's dependency on cars. Now, the idea is that people would be able to walk or cycle to work even in the height of summer. Ultimately, the project could incorporate neighbourhoods including Expo City, JLT, Al Khos, Downtown Dubai, Maidan and Academic City. It sort of looks like a glass polytunnel. If you look at the sort of the pictures of it, it sort of looks like it's sort of snaking its way through the city. That's the sort of, if you visualise it in your mind. Now, if it ever came to fruition, the strategy would obviously hugely complement Dubai's 2040 vision, which aims to make the Emirate a pedestrian-friendly 20-minute city. Joining us now to talk through more of the details and to also discuss the viability of the project is Baharash Bargarian. He's the chief executive of the developer URB, who are a highly experienced company involved in developing net zero sustainable cities. Hello, Baharash. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Good morning, Georgia. And it's a pleasure to be here again.
It is lovely to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, okay, tell me why you came up with this plan and how you came up with the idea. What was the genesis of the idea, so to speak?
Well, typically, URB is mainly known for creating new sustainable cities, and these are developments that are above and beyond the standard definition of sustainable cities. And typically, as a developer, our mission is to accelerate the world's transition towards sustainable developments. Now, when you have a different challenge, which is existing cities that are highly populated, and yet the mobility is one of the biggest backbones to creating livable cities and how people travel around. So we see this as a different challenge in line with our mission. So it's no longer about just looking at new developments, but how could we actually contribute to existing cities? And Dubai itself has a mission and a plan to become the most livable by 2040. And it also recently launched the 20-minute initiative, which is to get as many people to different parts of the city or to services that they need within less than 20 minutes. So we saw this as a unique challenge to create an initiative, a project that would first start as an R&D, research and development, that then we can then take forward and find a solution that is commercially viable where private investors could actually invest into the development itself. So we are moving away from this concept of creating infrastructure where it's funded by governments, but actually creating infrastructure that could be invested by private equity. And I see this as the future of sustainable developments, where people could invest in different types of assets, assets that promote a green economy, assets that promote a higher quality of life for the people who are living there. So we knew the challenge is going to be very unique. And in our case with the loop, what the final solution is, what you are seeing, or the, let's say the basis of a final solution, we saw that we needed to create something that is first multifunctional. So it's no longer just you're going to go from A to B, but actually it becomes a utility in itself.
Okay.
Something that you could actually use for different things. So in this case, we looked at different opportunities, how we could promote, let's say, green tourism or wellness tourism. That's why we integrated certain facilities within the structure. So wellness facilities, so people could actually go and use fitness, mm-hmm. outdoor gyms, even sports courts within that. And then we looked at other opportunities, how to create an environment that is totally resilient. So no matter what happens, whether you have a severe weather condition or event, or even in the summer, you know, most of the time, what I believe makes a truly sustainable city is how convenient and comfortable it is for residents to do things.
So I've got so many questions.
All right.
Okay, so obviously it is just a concept at the moment. And you are going to, if it were to ever happen, you would have to imprint it on an already existing city, which is tricky but not inconceivable in Dubai. There is a water canal that wasn't here when I first arrived that goes under 3 8-lane motorways. They managed to imprint that water canal quite happily. There's also a new bike track that runs along the Jumeirah Beach, the Umm Sakeen Beach, that wasn't there a year ago. And you know, you didn't think there was, you wouldn't have thought there was space for it, but there it is, and it's an absolute delight. So I know how this city can make things happen, even if it means knocking down villas and digging a lot. So I can imagine it happening. But I'm not quite sure how it can be sustainable, because it's going to be air conditioned, right? And by its very nature, it's also going to be a sort of greenhouse effect. So how on earth can it be a sustainable solution, even though it is getting people out of their cars?
Yeah, there's almost two parts to that.
So many
question.
Questions
yeah.
in what I just asked.
So,
yes.
So I would answer it first.
Okay.
What is it trying to mitigate?
Right? Okay.
So already, if you look at mobility, it's one of the biggest causes of greenhouse emissions.
Yes.
So especially here in UAE. Almost everybody is
has
traveling.
A gas guzzler.
Exactly.
Yes, horrible cars.
And your primary mode of transport is by cars, right? So is so how can we offset that? If we can get 80% of the people by 2040 using the loop, whether it's walking or cycling, we've already reduced a significant amount of carbon emissions. So you could argue that's one of the great things
offset.
Is offsetting, right?
Yeah.
And the other thing is, whenever we do a project, we always look at the life cycle assessment of the proposal, right? So there's a lot of exercises that goes into that to get the most efficient from an upstream point of view. And what I mean by upstream is anything that's up to the point that the building is constructed.
Okay.
So we look at materials, how we could actually source materials, or even look at materials that are even net zero. So today with technology, there are many even companies who are creating net zero glass. So they are using methods that are offsetting the carbon that's produced by creating that glass. So there are many ways that we can do it. And then people think today, air conditioning is the typical systems that you are seeing. But we can use evaporative cooling as an alternative, which, because in such type of environments, you don't want to cool it down to 21 or 19. It is getting it to a comfortable environment. And evaporative cooling can do that, and it requires significantly less energy than a standard air conditioning systems. And then the other way we could do it is not to think of the entire loop as an air conditioned system, but actually how we could create as many segments that are air conditioned, but sometimes they are not. So just to create that comfortable environment for someone to go from A to B as well. So there's a lot of optimizations that can go into the design to even make it much more efficient from an energy point of view.
How about this idea? There's mention of a kinetic floor. Now, the Business Breakfast perceived that as a little bit like a hamster wheel, where your motion essentially powers the thing. I thought that when you said kinetic floor, I was imagining travelators like you get in airports. Which one of us is right?
It's the first one.
That's the Business Breakfast got
exactly.
it right then.
It's one that generates energy. And this is one of the things that we're looking into. So it's a feasibility of that. So it's at the moment the technology that's available and the manufacturers who are producing that. It's not at a stage yet where it could generate the entire power that's required. But then we can offset that by adding some solar panels to the structure itself. And in a facility of such type, if you can use energy efficient systems, just such the one that I mentioned about evaporative cooling, we can actually require a very little amount of energy to actually function.
Okay, so how likely is this to be built, do you think?
So
if you had to put a percentage on it.
I always believe that if you have big ideas,
yeah.
right, and it's life-changing, change-making ideas. I think that any idea that can benefit not just the city itself, but actually benefit globally other cities, these are the ideas that I find our partners are willing to invest in. So at URB, we do have an incubator. So we already have a partner of investors who are investing in urban tech. So this, the loop will be part of that program itself. And for us, urban tech is the future of cities and the future of economies of cities. We are all moving into cities. So Dubai itself is going to be heavily populated and we need these types of solutions. And I would argue that these types of assets provide a far bigger return than a standard assets because we've approached it from a mixed use point of view. It's not just here's a infrastructure that's going to get you from A to B, but actually here's an infrastructure that has a mixed use of facilities. Now we are building to lease spaces, right? So spaces for wellness, tourism or brands to actually come on board to actually be able to create these types of destination, spaces for to grow food, right? So now we're contributing to the food security of the city itself. So we're trying to create a 0 mile concept at the same time. We've also integrated a system for the Hyperloop that could actually be integrated. So again, on the website.
That is another very big blue sky thought. We've been talking about Hyperloops ever since I arrived in Dubai about 8 years ago.
But it's how to future-proof this infrastructure to allow for this technology. So when it's available, it could be integrated. So that's, again, another economy for the loop as well. So if you look at, again, on our website, we have all the infographics that gives you the details of the typical structure itself. So the future proofing is also what's unique about the system itself.
Okay, I've got 30 seconds with you, but I want to ask, you know, you guys are clearly a company with a very global outlook. Do you find that Dubai is more enthusiastic about your big blue sky thinking than other cities? Or are, you know, we always think of Dubai and the UAE as sort of at the forefront of innovation. But actually, are most cities thinking along these lines?
I think by far Dubai is definitely leading. I think I always
believe... You don't
have
to say that just because you're here.
No. I think, well, I used to live in UK for more than 20 years, right?
So it's not happening there, I can tell you.
And I always believe that it always comes down to leadership, right? So if you have very good leadership with a vision, these types of projects are more likely to happen.
Yeah, worth mentioning that they're still arguing about the third runway at Heathrow in the United Kingdom. It's not going to happen there. Fantastic to have you in the studio. Thank you so much. As always, fascinating talking to you because it's a very intriguing idea and I'd love to see it happen. It sounds brilliant.
Thank you so much, Georgia.
Thank you very much indeed. Baharash Bargarian, Chief Executive of the developer Urb URB. They are very experienced in developing net zero sustainable cities. Absolutely fascinating stuff. We're discussing the plans for a 93-kilometre-long cycling and running indoor track in Dubai. It's designed to encourage residents to walk or cycle to work. Now, it's called The Loop. It would be climate-controlled, it would last year-round, and it would make it usable even in summer. And it's also designed to complement the nearly 819 kilometres of cycle tracks that are already built in the city. But Dubai is not the only emirate investing in cycling. Abu Dhabi already has its own loop being built, and it's more than 100 kilometres long. Now, the Emirate was also awarded a Bike City label from the Union Cycliste Internationale in 2021. Joining me now to talk through the growth of cycling culture in Abu Dhabi is Al-Nakara Al-Khalili, who is the CEO at the Abu Dhabi Cycling Club. Sir, thank you so much for joining me on Teams. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you, Georgia, for having me.
It's such a pleasure to have you on the line because I know that Abu Dhabi is also a very cycling-friendly city. Can you tell us a bit more about the strategy there? Is it mostly for outdoor cycling?
Yes, Georgia. Abu Dhabi cycling strategy is clear. To become a global leading cycling hub, as you mentioned, in November 2nd, 2021, Abu Dhabi won a Bike City label, and it was the first in Asia to receive this distinction. So the cycling strategy inclusive for everybody, either indoor or outdoor.
How cycling friendly is Abu Dhabi already? Do you have the packs of mammals, we call them, the middle-aged men in Lycra, going out and cycling in their hordes at the weekends?
Yeah, definitely. We will not win the recognition as a bike label if we were not accessible for everybody. It's the network is great now. It's connected at Dar. Currently, they are working on the biggest cycling path project. It's more about 470 kilometer. It's Georgia. It's for everybody. It's for people who want to explore, people who want to cycle to work, and also for people who wants to train and go fast, and also for tourists who want to come and go around Abu Dhabi and take a nice image of Abu Dhabi scene.
Did cycling get a bit of a boost through COVID-19? There seemed to be a real enthusiasm for exercising. You know, after that time when we were all locked in our houses, we weren't allowed to go out. Everyone was desperate, seemingly, to get out on a bike afterwards. Did that impact Abu Dhabi as well as Dubai?
Exactly. That has a huge impact on the cycling growth. We notice a big number of people cycle and big number of participation in our cycling events.
Do you have competitions there for kids, for adults, for all different levels? Because I have to admit that I always feel slightly threatened when I go to the proper cycling tracks, just because everyone else seems to be zooming past so quickly and I'm sort of still slightly wobbly.
Yes, we have in Hijriyat, probably we are the only, I think, country who have a dedicated cycling lane for training. Al Qudra in Dubai, Hijriyat in Abu Dhabi, we have Al Ain cycling track, we have Al Wathba cycling track. So it has different loops, different distances, as also it's width. It's nice, and there's always education and workshop to teach the beginners where to stay. And also now we have a good education level for the cyclists who keep on the left lane and try to also cater and care for the other cyclists who just want to come and enjoy and ride their bike. We have different loops, 3 kilometer in Hijriyat, 5 kilometer and 8, so it's for everybody with a different ability and riding skills, and we have also community events which cater for all the families and kids. We have dedicated time for them to start the race, and then the kind of pro people and the pro riders, they come later and they do their main event.
So I think there's something that neither of us are mentioning, which I think everyone must be slightly considering, everyone who's listening to this. And certainly anyone outside the UAE would be dazzled by the idea that cycling culture was growing here, because it does get very hot in the summer. You must see a drop off, during July and August, for example, or September as well this year, where people just aren't out on the tracks as much.
Yeah, this is normal, Georgia. This is it's we are lucky here. It's all season sports. It's the whole year you can cycle. Okay, it's hot during the summer, but sometimes we need to go out early in the morning or to go out after sunset. Plus now we have so many platform and smart trainers, so you can cycle also indoor and keep your fitness during summertime. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, it probably does drop off slightly. I mean, if you're listening to this, you're living in Abu Dhabi, you quite fancy getting out there on the track with your kids this weekend, what would you recommend people do? Can they rent a bike? Is there a specific place that they should go just to try it out?
Yes, I would suggest coming to Abu Dhabi Cycling Club. Abu Dhabi Cycling Club established in 2017. Probably it's the first and only cycling dedicated hub for in the MENA region and probably the world. We have recently moved to our new headquarters in Hijriyat Island with our partners, Wilfie and the service course and Colnago. We have many things to offer here, and we recommend everybody to come and visit Abu Dhabi Cycling Club. You have bike rental available. You have a storage where you can store your bike and keep it here with us. We have a nice coffee area, and also a retail shop where you can find also specialized merchandise of Abu Dhabi Cycling Club.
Oh, it's definitely the right weather to be getting started on that. Fantastic to speak to you, sir. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. And great to hear how cycling culture is getting a real boost in Abu Dhabi, thanks to the government and obviously thanks to the community there. Al-Nakara Al-Khalili, thank you so much for your time. CEO there of Abu Dhabi Cycling Club. Welcome back to The Agenda. Right, Mohammed Selman has joined me in the studio. But hilariously, I'm being heckled from the green room, from the control room, by Dane Swindles. I've got both. Yeah, it's getting awkward, Mohammed.
What's happening?
Well, because everything, what happened is you're not here when this happened, but it's awkward. So you say I can't do the sport. And so Zina or Andrew will go, yeah, Mohammed says he can't do the sport today. And I immediately turn around because Dane sits behind me.
Yeah.
And I go, Dane? And he's like, I'm fed up with being second choice. He's hurt. He's wounded.
He's wounded. What have I done?
It's very difficult.
Oh, no, what have you done?
No, it's you.
It's me.
Yeah, you need to be consistent. That's what I'm blaming you.
I need to be on the show
every
day.
You need to be
day.
On the show every day. You need to prioritize us above that. Here we go. Also, I accused Dane once of... I suggested that you had given me the lesson in how the transfer window works.
Uh-huh.
Apparently, I misremembered that. Dane says that he gave me the lesson in how the transfer window works.
No, I did. I very clearly remember that. It was last year. It was a slow sports news day because it was the transfer window. There was no live sport going on at all. And I gave you a whole rundown of what happens on transfer deadline
well,
day.
Well, that's how I remembered it too. But Dane's now looking at me through three sheets of glass, furious. Furious.
He said... Dane's a great guy. Dane is a great guy.
He's literally writing me abusive messages on the system. It's brilliant. Mohammed is a wonderful guy, though. He thinks he likes you. It's all me.
I'm getting the blame for this. I'm not the one in the wrong here.
Dane Swindles has been awake since 3 a.m. doing the news on the business breakfast, so he's clearly feeling a little bit more opinionated this morning than normal. Okay, Mohammed, let's talk sport because we are going to talk about cricket. There were a couple of big matches last night, no?
There were indeed. Let's start with India and New Zealand. So we had the third and final T20 over in Ahmedabad last night. Now it was 1-1 going into this one. So it was everything to play for. And in the end, it was the Shubman Gill show once again as India decimated New Zealand to win the series. So India batted first and posted a huge total of 234 for 4 in the 20 overs. That's an absolutely massive score for a T20 match. Now, 126 of those runs were scored by Shubman Gill. All right?
Wow.
He's India's
good man.
Opener. So he had 12 fours and 7
he
sixes.
He put in the work.
He really did, yeah. I mean, he's had a wonderful year so far. So 12 fours, 7 sixes. And in reply, New Zealand are bowled out for just 68 runs, with Hardik Pandya taking 4 for 16. But all the plaudits, of course, went to Shubman Gill for that destructive innings. Here he is speaking to his captain, Hardik Pandya, after the match.
I was very eager to, you know, go there and do what I love to do. And you gave me that confidence, especially today before I went on to the game. The way you just told me, match se pehle ki jaake, jaise main khelta hu, वैसे जाके खेलो कुछ एक्स्ट्रा करने की जरूरत नहीं है.
What does that mean, Georgia?
No idea. He lost me
so
near the end.
It basically means that he's praising his captain for giving him the confidence to play his way.
Good man.
So yeah, so that was good.
Good man. But it's a team game.
It is, yeah. And there's no doubt about it. This guy is the new superstar of Indian cricket. I mean, you think of Sachin Tendulkar, you think of Virat Kohli. Shubman Gill is the man. He's only 23. He now has a double century, 3 centuries, and a 50 in 12 innings so far this year. He also becomes only the 5th Indian player to score 100 across all 3 formats. What are those 3 formats, Georgia? Test cricket?
No idea.
ODI cricket and
T20.
Exactly, yeah.
He was born in 1999.
He was, imagine. Yeah,
2 years after I left school. Goodness me.
Yeah, yeah.
Good
wonderful
for him.
Player.
Great career ahead of him.
So that was India versus New Zealand, done and dusted. India take that series. Your beloved England.
Oh, yes.
Also in action last night.
We usually, for a time, we lost everything and now we've got rather good.
Yeah, but not in ODIs. However, they are back to winning ways with an easy 59-run win over South Africa last night. Now, this series was already won by South Africa, so it was a bit of a dead rubber, but... plenty of positives for England out of this one. It ends a worrying run of 5 successive ODI defeats. And more importantly, Jofra Archer is back.
Yeah.
So Jofra Archer is their star fast bowler. He was out with injury for a while. But the big man took 6 wickets last night, bowled really, really quick. I know Tom Urquhart was watching that match last night. He said that he even hurt a couple of batsmen, like physically injured them with his bowling.
Goodness me.
Yeah. So a really good boost for
England. They need to give him some sort of title, like
the destroyer.
The bowling of the bowler of the barbarian bowler.
Yeah, why not?
There we go.
Yeah.
But that'll catch on.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. So a really good boost for England.
Tell you something, tomorrow when he's playing and you hear the commentator say, here he is, he's the barbarian bowler, you'll know.
They know where it came from.
Where it came from.
Yeah, there you go. But yeah, so that was that. England getting a consolation win last night over South Africa in that ODI series.
Okay, let's talk football. Manchester United in action last night.
Yes, indeed. So United recorded an easy Carabao Cup semi-final second leg win over Nottingham Forest last night, which means that they set up a 1999 Wembley rematch with Newcastle later this month in the Carabao Cup final. Here's the moment when they scored in the 73rd minute to set up the win. I think it was Anthony Martial who scored. Yes, yeah, go ahead.
Here's Casemiro. Oh, lovely. Finds Martial. Anthony Martial. And here's Rashford. It's stopped. Martial!
Happy crowds there.
Yeah, over at Old Trafford, the Stretford end going nuts there. So United through to the finals of the Carabao Cup. They will now play Newcastle in the finals at Wembley on February the 26th. Put that one in your calendar, Georgia.
Well, it's already in my calendar.
Okay, it's good to know.
Do you know why the 26th is in my calendar?
It's your anniversary.
It's my birthday.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Close, though. Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, you had
it
a 50-50 chance. Yeah.
It was one
it's
or the
actually
other.
My birthday. It's also the day that the astronaut is going to go up to space.
Oh, is he?
For his six-month stint.
Sultan al-Nayadi.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. And
lovely.
Actually, I'm hoping to meet Sultan later on
I'm
today.
I'm sure you will, yeah. Yeah. You talked to Ban Ki-moon a couple of days ago. Talked to the head of the FIFA World Cup last week.
Caroline Stanbury.
Okay.
Bit of celebrity in there as well. Yeah, and now Sultan al-Nayadi today at 1 o'clock. Fingers crossed.
Oh, amazing.
Crossed.
Nice one.
Fingers crossed. Okay, let's more celebrity chat, because let's talk about American football. An NFL legend has retired. And then you put again?
Now, do you remember, Georgia, last year I came into the studio with an American football. Do you remember that?
I do remember. We got into terrible trouble.
Yeah, we almost lost.
Because you were throwing it around.
We almost lost our jobs because of
that. You nearly got me fired a month into the role.
That was exactly a year ago yesterday. So that was February 1st, 2022. And that was NFL superstar Tom Brady announcing his retirement from the game.
No way. He's retiring again.
Yeah. So what he did last time was exactly a year ago. He retired. Then 6 weeks later, he unretired.
Yeah. And got divorced.
Yeah, exactly. To Giselle, right?
Yeah. Giselle was not impressed by that about turn.
But apparently she's sent him a heartfelt message last night after he announced his official retirement again.
Well, that's very nice of him.
But six weeks later, after what he did last year, he unretired and said he had unfinished business. But last night, he posted this on his Instagram account.
Good morning, guys. I'll get to the point right away. I'm retiring for good. I know the process was a pretty big deal last time, so when I woke up this morning, I figured I'd just press record and let you guys know first. So I won't be long-winded. Like, you only get one super emotional retirement essay, and I used mine up last year. So really thank you guys so much to every single one of you for supporting me, my family, my friends, my teammates, my competitors.
Oh, I don't know.
I could go on forever.
It's still going on, though,
isn't
it?
Long-winded, isn't it?
Yeah, you said one long essay. I was like, mate, you're still going. It's been 50 seconds. I'm going to fade you, I'm afraid.
Yeah, so he is officially retiring again from the game. So he's a record 7-time Super Bowl winner. 6 of those Super Bowls came with the New England Patriots. One of them came with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers back in 2021. 23 seasons altogether in the NFL, but definitely a future Hall of Famer and a legend of the game, retiring again.
Yeah, I don't believe it for a minute. Mohamed Salaman, as always, pleasure to have you in the studio. Thank you so much for joining us. You got 30 seconds if you want to do golf.
Okay, because I played in the Pro-Am of the Russell Kimmel Championship last week, so I just want to plug that in.
You should. But it was amazing. Who did you play with?
I played with Oliver Wilson. We came third.
Good on you. I imagine you did most of the running there.
A little bit, yeah. I was sort of carrying my team there. But I left my golf bag in rack.
Oh.
And it's still there.
You're going to have to go
exactly,
up
exactly, yeah.
Who's leading the, who's
but
on the
very
leaderboard
quickly,
now?
Yeah, Matthew Baldwin is has the early lead over at Al Hamra Golf Club. He's on 5 under par through 11 holes currently. Mark Warren and the defending champion Rasmus Højgaard are just one shot back as well.
It has strong memories for me, the Al Hamra Golf Club. It was one of my first days out with the Business Breakfast team when I was producing them. First time we ever saw daylight, really, because the last studios were very dark. Anyway, you're listening to The Agenda. Welcome back to the show. Georgia here with you till one. Now, if you've headed up towards Atlantis over the last few days, you might have spotted a strange addition because there's a new attraction at Atlantis, the Palm, and it involves a giant white balloon. If you go anywhere near the top of the Palm, I promise you, you can't miss it. And earlier I spoke to Claire Aishorn, who is the general manager of the Dubai Balloon, to find out more.
The Dubai Balloon is a tethered helium balloon, which is located at Atlantis Aquaventure. The balloon actually goes up to 300 meters, which is approximately three times higher than a 33-story building. I know that is quite high, but you can imagine how spectacular and breathtaking those views are over the city. Guests on board will be able to see the world's largest water park, the world's largest fountain show, which is at the Point, Burj Al Arab, the marina skyline. On clear days, you'll be able to see the downtown skyline and as well as Burj Khalifa, which are most of the famous landmarks in Dubai.
This sounds really, really very high up indeed. What, like, I'm already getting nervous. I get vertigo. So what kind of capsule are you in that keeps you safe?
So you are in a gondola. So you'll go on board a gondola. There is netting around it. And you have a balloon that is above you that's filled with helium. It is also tethered down to the ground, very securely anchored to the ground by a cable.
So it can't just suddenly drift off if there's a sudden gust of wind.
No, we are monitoring the winds. So it's not like a hot air balloon. This balloon is actually tethered down to the ground, very securely anchored to a winch room that you will always land and take off at the same destination.
Okay, so if I want to go on it, do I have to get access to Aquaventure first, or can you just go up the Palm now and try it out?
You could go directly to the Palm. We are located outside of the avenues, close to the monorail. We have a ticket desk out there where you can come and purchase your tickets and go through the avenues to locate us. Guests that are also inside Aquaventure Water Park will be able to come directly to the attraction and purchase their ticket there.
How much does it cost, and how long does the whole experience last?
So the flight is a 10-minute experience. We have a regular ticket for adults, which is 175 dirhams. Children 3 years of age to 12 years of age are 75 dirhams, and below 3 years of age are free. And then for those that are wanting to skip the queue, we have a fast pass access, which also includes a beverage at our lounge. And that ticket price is adults for 275 and children 125 dirhams.
And what's it like when you're actually in the gondola itself?
Well, I think it's incredible. So when I've gone up, what is the most breathtaking part about it is definitely the views. You can see over the whole city, and you look at the, you know, the city of Dubai, and it's absolutely incredible.
Can you go up it at night?
Yes, 100%. And it's quite funny because you wouldn't think that the views are going to be that great at night. But let me tell you, I am kind of fighting with myself to see which are the better views in the day or the night. And both are absolutely sensational. They both have a completely different feel.
That is Claire Aishorn, who's the general manager of the Dubai Balloon, speaking to me on the launch, quite literally, of that new attraction by Atlantis, the Palm. Right, welcome back to The Agenda. Georgia Tolley here. Now, PayPal is the latest big tech company to announce it is laying off staff. The US-based fintech say it's planning to cut 7% of its workforce. That is about 2,000 employees. The payments firm joined Alphabet, Amazon, Meta, Twitter, Microsoft and Salesforce, all of whom are laying off employees in a bid to rein in costs. All of those companies laying off literally thousands of people. However, while the rest of the world is firing people, we are in the midst of a hiring boom. That is according to recruitment expert John Armstrong. He's the founder of JCA Associates. Now, he says they're seeing the biggest demand for tech professionals in 12 years. Now, I couldn't let John get away with sending me a text message along those lines without hauling him into the studio to ask him to explain himself. And he has indeed joined me in the studio. John, how are you doing?
Morning, George. Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Yeah, nice.
Lovely to have you here. Okay, so give me a little bit more details. You specialise in tech headhunting. Business really that good? The best you've seen in 12 years?
Yes, it's the best Q1 we've had since we started 12 years ago. You know, the amount of opportunities we're receiving from our clients is phenomenal, really. So in light of the layoffs recently, it's a complete opposite, which we can talk about more in a moment.
Yeah, I mean, is that partly because you guys are established, or is it because the market really is growing that fast?
Well, obviously, us being established will help. Some of our clients that we were working with 6 or 12 years ago, they've moved on to new companies, and we're still, you know, hiring for those people just in different companies. So obviously, that helps. But there are certain areas within tech that are booming at the moment here in the Middle East, specifically UAE, which is cybersecurity, physical security, and digital transformation. They're the really sort of boom areas at the moment.
You must be rubbing your hands whenever you hear of a big multinational laying people off, because if they also lay people off in the United Arab Emirates, then you can snaffle those, right, and redistribute them among your other clients. Do you mainly work with local companies, or do you work with the big, you know, multinationals as well?
It's mostly multinationals, but not the sort of aforenamed companies that have been laying people off. They're that big, they don't typically need to use recruitment agencies. So most of our clients are multinationals who perhaps a smaller presence here in the region and have between 10 or 100 people in the UAE, for example. So that's kind of our sweet spot. So big tech companies, but not necessarily with such a big presence in the Middle East. Hence, they're growing.
How? I mean, why are we seeing so many people getting fired globally? It seems a real, I don't know, it seems really counterintuitive considering the amount of time we're all spending in digital spaces now. And, you know, we keep talking here in Dubai about the growth of the metaverse and, you know, the growth of our digital lives rather than the decline. What's going on?
Well, put simply, I do feel that companies have basically overhired post-pandemic. So obviously, there was a big surge in activity when everyone was allowed to go out without a mask and life became, you know, more normalised. But you know, if you actually look at the stats, yes, 10,000 people, for example, have just been let go by Microsoft, which is obviously very unfortunate for those individuals. But they actually hired 40,000 people last year. So those are the stats that are not being so widely spread around. I mean, of course, people are talking about the layoffs, but actually, in reality, they've still grown year on year. Another example will be Amazon. For example, in 2019, they had around 800,000 employees. They've now doubled that to 1.6 million. So actually, year on year, the growth is still there.
Yeah, so while they're laying off a few thousand here and there, we're talking about companies with, I mean, literally millions of employees. That's staggering. Okay, so you get a sense there that although the multinationals are struggling, you know, the big tech companies are struggling, it definitely isn't something you're seeing here. Is there any hint of any slowdown here at all?
A little bit, yes. So in some areas, like, for example, senior sales positions, there's perhaps a reluctance to go and hire someone for a $250,000 or $350,000 salary when, you know, companies are looking at what the bigger players are doing. But in actual pure tech roles, software developers, software engineers, solution architects, project managers, the demand is still there. The projects are still running. So those people are still required.
Okay, so whenever they do these job surveys or salary surveys, you always hear that it's the tech people who are getting the pay rises, the tech people that are getting nicely sort of settled into new jobs. For people out there who are listening and basically want a bit of a slice of this pie, how easy is it to get into tech? You know, can you do a course and then move sideways?
It's very difficult and it's a very fluid market. So, you know, what might be a hot skill now, you might train it for the next year and then a year later, it's not so much in demand. So that's a bit of a challenge in itself. And of course, you know, there will be a preference to hire people that have come from tech from day one.
Yeah.
But I would advise younger people, students out there to you know, invest more time in maybe how to develop software, for example. Clearly, younger generations spend a lot of time on their iPads or whatever. Why not actually learn a skill that could be useful?
Do you find that people in the tech space just have to keep on training themselves all the time because the market just moves so quickly? I mean, even in rate And why I say that, in radio, not a great deal has changed, to be honest. You know, my skills that I have, the editing skills I had that I learned at university and my postgrad are pretty much the same now. Not a great deal's shifted, but that must be entirely different in the tech space.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are a few programming languages, for example, that have been around for 20, 30, 40 years, but, you know, you could not survive by just knowing those languages. So, yeah, of course, yeah, there's new technology coming out all the time. And a version of something that was around 25 years ago is completely different today. It's still around, but it's a totally different version.
I've still got my mini disc player somewhere in the back, although needless to say, I don't use that for recording anymore. John, the message has come in here from Chet saying, he says he met you 10 years ago.
Okay.
He says he describes you as a recruitment legend, no less.
Oh, thanks, Chet.
There you go. You're in with a job already, Chet. What are the recommended upskilling areas for a seasoned tech seller in the current market condition?
Ooh. So a tech seller, sorry, a tech sales person, I assume.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, cybersecurity is hot right now. So yeah, that would be not my number one recommendation.
There you go, Chet. You need to go into cybersecurity. Goodness, I mean, do you know, I very rarely do interviews now about cybersecurity on the radio because everyone just says the same thing, that you need to change your passwords. Yeah. And we're like, yeah, we got that. We figured that.
Well, passwords might not be necessary. I mean, there's different ways of actually securing your devices or data. And so passwords might be a thing of the past.
Are you telling me that it is now time, that the market's moved so fast that it is now time for me to do more interviews about cybersecurity?
Absolutely.
That maybe people will have refreshed their lines on how it works. Absolutely fascinating to hear how you're getting people in. Where are you recruiting people from? Are there enough people here in the UAE, or are you needing to look externally?
Definitely abroad. So for the tech professionals, I mean, there is a bit of a fight for these people here. If they're already here, there's a lot of companies all looking for the same talent. So yes, we're hiring people from all over the world. That could be as far as South America. It could be Europe, Ukraine, Russia, Canada, South Africa, Australia. So yeah, pretty much anywhere where those skills lie. And of course, Dubai is always going to be an attractive location to come to.
Are they getting good packages?
Yeah, exactly. And of course, the dollar slash dirham is quite strong against a lot of the other currencies right now. So
it looks good, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, are you competing with Saudi for those people? Because obviously the salaries in Saudi sound astronomical.
Yes. I mean, look, there's always going to be a bit of competition, but yes, some of the companies in Saudi are paying huge packages, but not all of them. So I would say probably 70% of the companies in Saudi have similar salaries, but some do offer astronomical sums. So,
and it's just not as fun there. Let's be honest. It's just not as fun. These are young lads, young women.
I did enjoy the Leap event last year. I can't, unfortunately, attend next week. My colleagues are going, but I'll be in the UK instead. So, yeah.
Actually, yeah, the events are pretty special, aren't they? Amazing stuff. Great to have you in, John. As always, thank you so much for your insights on why we are not facing a tech layoff here. In fact, we are facing the complete opposite. John is seeing the biggest demand for tech professionals in 12 years. Thank you so much. Great to speak to you as ever. John Armstrong there, the founder of JCA Associates, speaking right here on The Agenda on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there. You're listening to The Agenda on Dubai Eye 103.8. Now, we have been discussing major job cuts that have been announced by the big tech firms. Thousands of people have been laid off by Amazon, Alphabet, Meta, Twitter, Microsoft, and also Salesforce. Streaming giant Spotify and online payments firm PayPal, plus the digital search company Pinterest, have also confirmed that they're going to reduce their staff count. But one tech giant that hasn't announced job cuts is Apple. But why is that? Like, how have they got away with it? Here to tell us why is Daniel Ives. Now, he's the Managing Director and Senior Equity Research Analyst at the wealth management firm Wedbush Securities in the United States. So while it's morning for us, it is quite late evening for Daniel. Thank you so much for joining us on the line.
Yeah, great to be here.
Really lovely to speak to you. Now, what is going on? How, we all know that Apple is a great company and we're all buying their products and, you know, they post record profits on a regular basis. But how are they managing to escape the great big tech layoff of 2022-23?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think we're seeing layoffs across the board because a lot of these tech firms were spending money like 1980s rock stars. But Apple was not. And, you know, they hired much more tactically over the last few years. which is why you're not seeing the level of layoffs from Apple. And I think that's really going to come out with earnings over the next 24 hours.
Does that come down to the leadership? You know, Tim Cook, old hand, experienced, level-headed. Do you think that's, you know, they didn't overhire because he knew his space?
Look, I think Tim Cook is the reason he's a Hall of Fame CEO, because he's able to navigate Apple through ups and downs, which is why I view them as a rock of Gibraltar tech stock, even in this, you know, what I'll call a softer economic environment. A lot of these other tech firms, they hired at such a hyper growth rate, assuming that would never end. And really what's happened is the hyper growth story, the clock struck midnight for tech, but Apple is, I think, much better positioned than other tech stalwarts.
We have also heard headlines that the Apple CEO, Tim Cook, actually took a pay cut in 2023 to $49 million. His compensation is going to be down from 95%. I mean, that's extraordinary. Why do we think he's taken that cut? Do you think that's in order to save jobs?
Look, I think it also sends a signal to the street that, you know, he ultimately recognizes him taking a cut sends a signal. And I think also it's why Cook's a leader. And I think you're going to see more and more job cuts across tech. But I think the reason Apple is in the position it is because strategically, this is a company that's able to see the forest of the trees. And that's why they're in this situation.
Are there any other sort of old hand tech companies that would fall into the same bracket in your view?
Look, I think the closest you'd get would be Microsoft, you know, because even though they just laid off 10,000, it's still a company that I think is as well positioned when it comes to cloud as probably any in the market. Look, I think IBM and some others, but ultimately 95% of tech companies were hiring that the hyper growth was going to continue. And now all of a sudden it's not. And I think that's why that separates Apple from other tech giants in what's still a white-knuckle environment, especially for tech workers.
Really interesting to speak to you, Daniel. Thank you so much for staying up late and taking the time to join us on the line. That's Daniel Ives. He's the Managing Director and Senior Equity Research Analyst at the wealth management firm Wedbush Securities in the United States. Well, last week I was in discussion with Shiraz Sethi, who's regional head of employment right here at Dentons Middle East. We were discussing those tech layoffs and the fact that we didn't seem to be seeing it in the tech sector right here in the UAE. But he did tell me that some people in some sectors were getting fired.
We are seeing it in different industries. So you've got the financial institutions. They are, you know, also looking at just readdressing their sort of workforce and whether they need certain people in certain jobs. You know, for example, what we've seen in the financial industry is coupling of jobs. So, you know, sort of different types of jobs sort of being collated into one and sort of joined up and sort of people taking up jobs which have dual roles. So that's something that's happening. The healthcare industry has also had some impact, as well as the energy companies. But generally speaking, it's been very limited. You know, as I said, I advise a number of companies here in the UAE on sort of exits, redundancies. We've seen, you know, an increase at the start of the year, but it's not a huge amount that we would normally expect in a downturn.
Shiraz Sethi also told us what happens to people when they do get laid off here in the UAE, because, of course, the laws have changed here. You no longer have to leave the country immediately.
So in the UAE, it's slightly different. Obviously, in the US, UK, if people lose their jobs, they don't necessarily have a dagger over their head in terms of, so as to speak, in terms of having to find alternative employment pretty quickly, because otherwise they will not be able to live or remain in the UAE itself. But, you know, generally speaking, what we're seeing in the UAE is that because there is this war on talent, you know, companies are looking for good quality people. And if people are losing their job as a result of a recession or as a result of an economic downturn, these people are being picked up pretty quickly. And in the event that they're not, what employees are doing is they are retraining themselves or redeploying themselves into other sectors or under other industries to remain work in the UAE.
Good to get a lens there on the employment sector right here in Dubai. Shiraz Sethi there, Regional Head of Employment at Dentons Middle East, giving us a little bit of an update.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there, welcome back to the show. Now, there is so much going on in the city this week, not least at Arab Health, which is proving so popular that there are regular traffic jams around the World Trade Center. Meanwhile, longevity, the metaverse and holograms are the focus of a summit on the future of healthcare, which is actually taking place in the Museum of the Future right now. It's called the Future Health Summit. It's bringing together government officials and CEOs in healthcare to discuss how things like artificial intelligence, augmented reality and virtual reality will revolutionise the space. Also up for discussion is preventative healthcare and how the UAE is making strides to be at the forefront of that shift. G42 Healthcare are already working on bringing personalised medicine to its patients. And I'm actually joined on the line now by one of the speakers from the Future Health Summit, G42 Healthcare's Senior Director of Operations, Francesco Rediva, who joins me from the very busy Museum of the Future. Hello there, Francesco. How are you?
Yes, pleasure to meet you, Georgia.
It's lovely to meet you virtually. This is the way that the world is going, isn't it? That's what we're all going to hear about. Tell me, it is generally agreed that the latest major trend in healthcare will be this personalised medicine. But what does that actually mean in practical terms? Does it mean that I'm going to get different pills to take to somebody else?
Yes, George, a very good question. In fact, we're living in a new age where actually genomic data is ushering a new era of highly personalized precision medicine, where actually patient, as you rightly said, can essentially expect to have a tailored treatment, which is based depending on their genetic makeup. And precision medicine is, in fact, it's increasingly emerging disease treatment and prevention approach, right? They consider the patient individuality, right? Your genes, your environment, your lifestyle. And this is definitely the future of healthcare.
It sounds incredibly high tech. It sounds incredibly expensive. Is G42 already working on providing this type of treatment here in the UAE?
Yes, absolutely. G42 is supporting the government vision for personalized healthcare. In fact, we work with pharmaceutical companies to bring precision therapies to market using our contract research organization. We have our Biogenics Lab in Masdar City, Abu Dhabi, which offers over 250 comprehensive clinical genetic testing panel, which are state-of-the-art sequencing technologies with very fast turnaround time. And we have also brought advanced capabilities to the region from all over the world into our Omics Center of Excellence, which is the largest and most comprehensive lab worldwide with bioinformatics, biobanking capabilities that are actually powering cutting-edge clinical impact.
Okay, so you might have a few patients here and there who are already getting these types of personalised medicines, this personalised treatment. It must still be very expensive, though. When do you think it will become widespread? When do you think it will become affordable enough for our insurance companies not to pass out when they hear about it?
Yeah, indeed. So while actually this term and this new wave of medicine is actually still relatively new, we have seen much progress, right, in the course of the last few years. Now, it is ours, as well as the UAE vision, is to expand the access, you know, across healthcare in order to predict, prevent and treat any patient, right? And UAE is leading in this regard, in this transformation. Right, and positioning itself as a global life science hub. And this is for humanity, it's for everyone, right? It's not something for the elite or the fortunate ones, but ultimately this is indeed moving from reactive care into preventative, personalized, predictive, which is going to be relevant for each one of us.
How does it feel down there being at this summit? Because there's some very highbrow people attending, lots of amazing speakers. Does it feel like you're on the cusp of something new, that we're literally moving into a new era of healthcare?
Yeah, well said, Georgia. In fact, I mean, this is a unique, venue, right? The most amazing, most futuristic building in the world. And in fact, we share the vision, right? Specifically for healthcare, because healthcare is indeed on the cusp of a major transformation where Dubai, UAE, and G42 Healthcare are at the forefront of really implementing, really executing on these bold promises, but for today, right? Not for the future. And this is why the excitement level in the room, at the summit, and more generally speaking, at Arab Health these days is quite palpable.
Oh, it's good news that we were able to catch you just before you're about to give your own speech there at the Future Health Summit. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Georgia.
It's like you're our reporter as well. It's amazing. We're getting a real sense of the vibe down there. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Georgia. Have a good rest of the day.
Thank you very much. Have a good afternoon indeed. That was G42 Healthcare's Senior Director of Operations, Francesco Redivo, giving us a little bit of a taste of what's to come in the healthcare sector, literally seconds before he goes on stage to give his speech. So fantastic to have him join us.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Welcome back to The Agenda. Georgia Tolley here, keeping you company till one. And it is UAE Innovation Month. Apparently, everyone can participate with initiatives across schools, government departments and communities. And they're all designed to create a culture of innovation, from hackathons to competitions and awards. The hope is that the initiative will further strengthen the country's position as a global hub for innovation. But how does it actually work? I've been speaking to Abir Talak. She's director of the Mohammed bin Rashid Centre for Government Innovation. And she's in charge of the UAE Innovation campaign. I asked her all about it.
UAE Innovates was actually launched in 2015 under the directives of His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, our Vice President, Prime Minister and ruler of Dubai. So UAE Innovates is a national initiative launched to encourage, celebrate and shed light over efforts and innovation practices and innovative models that the government practices here in the UAE. The flagship celebration or month that reoccurs every February is the UAE Innovation Month, which is, again, a month-long platform bringing together entities, institutions, individuals in the government, private sector, as well as the academic institutions and the whole community together to celebrate and highlight innovation in the UAE.
Is the general gist that it's sort of blue sky thinking? So anyone who's doing anything that's unusual or intriguing would be included in this celebration?
So it is to, you know, shed light, celebrate innovators, innovative ideas, innovative solutions across all sectors, all disciplines, not just public sector, you know, private, what's going on in schools and universities, students, community.
I could really hear the passion in your voice when you spoke about it, because obviously, as director, you must live and breathe this project. You must live and breathe innovation. And I'm interested to know that if you've been running it since 2015, what actually distinguishes UAE Innovates 2023, this year's festival, from previous editions?
The key difference with this year's edition is the month's focus on impact, celebrating innovations that help promote improvements in all sectors and services. And we will witness hundreds of in-person and some virtual events that will bring together this wide participation of different entities, institutions, individuals across the government and private sectors, as I mentioned, and members of the societies. We have added a special category at the UAE Innovates Award as the best innovation supporting sustainability. Every year we do celebrate and we do a call out, the UAE Innovates Award, where we go look for public sector innovations within categories. We have clear categories, criteria for this award. But this year, we want to celebrate the best innovation supporting sustainability.
Now, obviously, if it's been running for 8 years, you must have seen the different ways in which this festival impacts the culture of innovation here in the UAE. Can you give me a sense of how you've evidenced that?
The impact has been significant since 2015, 2016. We want to aim, and this year's aim is to position this event as a global, in a global context. Its impact to extend far beyond the UAE's border and touch people on every continent. So we have reached to many other countries who reached out to us actually to take part in participating in UAE Innovation Month in their respective countries or to have a presence here in the UAE in February. So this has been a huge evidence that the impact is clear. Culture of innovation in our entities, in our schools, in the public.
So if people want to get involved this year, what type of individuals can engage with it? Is it, do you reach out to schools? Do you reach out to universities? You know, can I take part with my company, for example, here at the radio station?
Yes, actually, if you visit UAE Innovate's website, you will find out that there are many activities happening, different call-outs happening at different levels. We have engagement opportunities with the federal and local government entities. We have engagement happening with the private sector. Different schools are doing different activities. There's a special edition for this year where we at the Mohammed bin Rashid Center for Government Innovation will be participating in an UAE Innovates exhibition at the Global Village that will run February through February 22nd to the 26th, where we will be also focusing on sustainability-related innovative projects. We are trying to reach to the community, and being at the Global Village this year will give us this platform and this reach. You will be able to participate at different activities.
So that was Abir Talak, who is director of the Mohammed bin Rashid Center for Government Innovation, discussing their UAE Innovates, which will last for the whole of February. The Agenda is live Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. till 1 p.m.